Okay, so despite the disgusting reports that we read and hear about every day in the media, from the treatment of the Palestinians to the war in Afghanistan to just the general brutal priorities of the system, which mean that thousands of people starve to death every single day, the idea that revolution or indeed any kind of social change would be violent and must therefore not happen somehow manages to endure. Those at the top of society create more and more violence, but at the same time, these very same people argue that we shouldn't try to strive for a different sort of a world because that change itself may just involve violence. Now, what I'm going to be arguing today is that social change, be it winning reforms under the current system or revolutionary change, always involves violence. Not because of the morality or the will or intent of those of us who are actually striving for that change. Far from it. The violence always comes from those who are opposed to change and want to stop it from happening. Any violence is because those who want to see society continue down the same path, same barbarous path as it's currently on, will do anything to protect their power and privilege against those of us who challenge it. Now, what I'm going to be arguing today is very much based on the words of Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass was born in 1818 in America into slavery. He escaped his bondage at age 20 and spent the rest of his life struggling to win the freedom of other black slaves in America through both legal and illegal means. Douglass said, "Let me give you a word of the philosophy of reform. The whole history of the progress of human liberty shows that all concessions yet made to her august claims have been made of earnest struggle. The conflict has been exciting, agitating, all-absorbing, and for the time being putting all other tumults to silence. It must do this or it does nothing. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favour freedom yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without ploughing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. Find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you have found out the exact measure of injustice and wrong which will be imposed upon them, and these will continue till they are resisted with either words or blows or both. Men may not get all they pay for in this world, but they must certainly pay for all they get." Now, we live in a world where that measure of injustice and wrong is extremely high. We live in a profoundly violent world. Every day, we see the terrible violence being inflicted upon the Palestinian people. We see the further threat of war in Iran to this day. We see the inhumane treatment of refugees and Aboriginal people in this country. And we see the degradation and humiliation associated with global poverty. Now, capitalism is a system in which a tiny minority, the ruling class, own and control everything, whilst the vast majority, the working class, produce everything, but get very little in return. This class division is a fundamental fact of capitalism. You can't have capitalism without it. Now, no system that's based on the exploitation of the overwhelming majority by a tiny minority, no system based on such an unequal and exploitative relationship can maintain itself without violence and coercion. And so the working class needs to be taught to submit to this relationship. We're taught to accept the system of capitalism. We're taught that it's human nature to live in class-stratified societies, despite the fact that these forms of societies have only existed for a tiny minority of human history. We're taught that the only way to get change is to look to beneficent rulers at the top of society reforming things. And most importantly, we're taught that there's no alternative to the system of capitalism. So why bother trying to change anything? It will just lead to violence anyhow. But people don't simply submit to this relationship or uncritically accept it. On a regular and periodic basis, we get huge surges in conflict as people stand up and say enough is enough. When these ideas that we're taught are rejected, the ruling class turns to more drastic measures. The bosses and politicians have to rely ultimately on guns and force. That's why workers on picket lines and protesters on the street are so frequently met with the violence of those who are at the front line of the maintenance of the current order, the police. Now, the police form one of the many wings of the capitalist state. The state consists of those institutions which provide the day-to-day running of capitalism. The state in modern capitalist society consists of the parliament, the police, the military, the courts, the prison system and the bureaucracy of government departments. The state's all around us, runs an education system, hospitals and has a role in developing infrastructure such as roads and rail networks. But crucially, the state provides the infrastructure that capitalism requires, be it a decent transportation system or a compliant workforce, for business as usual. It ensures that obstacles to a nation state's capitalist class getting more profits are removed. So, for example, the police protect private property, the judiciary maintains law and order, the education system reinforces social norms and ensures the acquiescence of the population to the system of capitalism. Now, one of the very few things that I remember from my first year politics subjects at university, it was a while ago now, was being taught that the nation state has a monopoly over the legitimate use of violence. Now, what my lecturer meant by this was that those institutions that I've listed have been given the legitimate right to, for example, go to war. The state is allowed to, and indeed is expected to be violent because it has been given the role of protecting the interests of the capitalist class. Now, lying at capitalism's very heart is the need for bosses to make more and more profits. This is a competitive struggle. Companies need to compete with each other to stay ahead of their business rivals. And this is also an international competition. Nation states need to provide the best possible conditions for the companies of that country so that those companies can compete most effectively on the world stage. Now, this international competition, which is usually consigned to the civilized sphere of boardrooms and the back rooms of things like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, periodically breaks out into open warfare, such as we see in the Middle East today. Now, the violence of the system is not incidental. It is absolutely a product of the logic of capitalism. And the history of capitalism proves this. The transatlantic slave trade, which established capitalism in America, is estimated to have killed as many as 10 million Africans. And when you look at the struggles to end capitalism, which I'll be talking about in more detail later, we see the extent to which the capitalist class is prepared to clamp down on people who object to their vicious rule. A serious opposition to violence must therefore go with opposition to capitalism, the system which puts profits ahead of everything else, including human lives. Now, considering the power and privilege that this system provides for the rich and powerful in the ruling class, is it really any wonder that this tiny minority who have this monopoly over violence will not simply sit back and allow our side to have a turn at running society for ourselves? Indeed, in most cases, their side doesn't even allow for reforms to make our life better without a fight. As Frederick Douglass put it, the whole history of the progress of human liberty shows that all concessions yet made to her august claims have been born of earnest struggle. Now, the example of Chile in 1973 shows the lengths that the bosses will go to in order to protect their system. In 1970, a left-wing government headed by Salvador Allende was elected in Chile. This government argued that there was a special Chilean road to socialism. This road to socialism, the argument went, meant that those key institutions of the state that I listed before, such as the military and the police, could be used to advance the cause of socialism in Chile. But there's a problem here. Because as I've said, the state exists to ensure the interests of the capitalist class. So given this, if you're actually striving for a world without capitalism, then how can you use those very same institutions to actually achieve this? Now, in Chile, limited reforms, though certainly not to the extent of introducing socialism, were introduced by the left-wing government. Tragically, though, even these limited reforms were too much for the ruling class, and a brutal military coup led by the dictator Augusto Pinochet came down upon the heads of the Chilean people. Socialists who looked to the Allende government argued that it provided a peaceful means for achieving socialism. But the tragic irony is that this argument actually demobilised the working class and the movement. Had the working class had the political leadership to argue the need to defend the gains of the government and to take them forward, had it been prepared to defend the gains by force when necessary, then it would not have been the case that hundreds of thousands of Chileans were subject to inhumane torture, abuse, rape and disappearance. 30,000 Chileans would not have been killed at the hands of Pinochet. Now, the Chilean example is but one of many in human history which show that those in power did not give up that power without a fight. But this doesn't mean, though, that it's impossible to win some gains and progressive reforms from the ruling class. But as Douglas said, we may not get all we pay for in this world, but we must certainly pay for all we get. Even the limited wins that we've had under capitalism are born of struggle. Think of something as seemingly benign as the universal right to vote. Well, actually, this was only won through a long, hard and often violent campaign. Sometimes these victories are gained with relatively little opposition from the ruling class, whilst at other times the victories are hard fought and bloody. Ideas and actions don't exist in an abstract world. Violence, like non-violence, is a tactic, and in different circumstances, either may be appropriate. Socialists do not mindlessly glorify violence. In the same way, we do not mindlessly condemn it. But we acknowledge that power concedes nothing without a struggle. We look at the specifics of the violence, of who committed it, what the demands of the struggle were, and what the effects of the violence will have on the movement. A few years ago, Chris Hurley, the police officer on Palm Island in Queensland, murdered Aboriginal man Murungi Dumiji. In response to Murungi's death and deaths of thousands of other Aboriginal people, the people of Palm Island rioted. They rioted. They committed a violent act in order to try to redress the wrongs committed against Aboriginal people and to gain some justice for Murungi. Now, there's a world of difference between racist cops killing Aboriginal people and the racist state continuing with the oppression of Aboriginal people and Aboriginal people fighting back for their rights. If we do not stand with Aboriginal people when they fight back against the racist system, we capitulate to that racism. If we don't stand with them, then we're sending a message that they must accept the racism that they're daily subjected to by the police. They must accept the poverty and the degradation and the brutality of 220 years of occupation of this country because we don't agree with how they choose to fight. This would be the ultimate racist hypocrisy. We must stand side by side with people when they take a stand against this system. Now, Gandhi made the mistake of arguing that violence was simply an abstract moral question and therefore equated the violence of the capitalist state with the organised military and policing forces of that state with the violence of capitalism's victims. He failed to see that the violence of the oppressed can in no way be measured against the violence of the oppressor. The slave who strikes back at his or her owner to be free does so justly. Now, it's often assumed that the movement to get Britain out of India was a successful non-violent movement. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. The effect of Gandhi's philosophy of non-violence was not to stop violence, but to actually encourage the state to be as repressive as possible. The capitalist state did not concede to Gandhi's morality, but rather stepped up the violence against the movement. It was not Gandhi's philosophy, but the rising activity of the angry peasants and workers, which meant that the costs for the British of maintaining its colony outweighed the shrinking benefits. Angry peasants burning down buildings of the colonial establishment and workers going out on strike against Britain and its local backers proved the price that Britain would have to pay in order to maintain its colony. And this is the real violence that the ruling class are concerned with, the violence against their profits. It was mass collective action, not non-violence, that drove Britain out of India. Independence became inevitable. The only question was what form it would take. Now, a movement united along class lines could have constructed a united India. But because Gandhi pulled back from the movement at vital points, such as during general strikes in India, because he feared the movement was getting out of his control, he derailed the popular upsurges, and angry peasants and workers turned to opportunist religious leaders who demanded independence on the basis of partition, the division of Hindu India and Muslim Pakistan. In the chaos that followed, millions were murdered. Those fighting for liberation must make victory their commitment and see violence as a tactical question within that struggle. And it's only a mass working class revolutionary movement that can achieve this victory. In order to get rid of capitalism, we need to change the way in which society treats the majority of people who live in this world, the working class, who do all the work and produce everything under capitalism. This transformation can only happen by ordinary working class people seizing control of the political and economic institutions of power of society. The only way this can happen is by getting rid of the existing state mechanics, which are there only to support the existing ruling class and establishing a new state, a truly workers' democracy. And this is only possible through revolution. The working class can build socialism if it can overthrow this system, and the only way to get to socialism is by a revolution led by the working class. No other class has the working class's power or our natural propensity towards organising around the principles of solidarity. While the ruling class relies on violence to maintain its rule, workers have a lot more on our side. Our social power lies in the fact that we're the ones who produce, for example, the food, electricity and transport that people need to live. And this is what gives the working class its power. It can stop production and the flow of profits. So it's not the size of the tanks or the guns that our side controls, or you know, how good we personally are at street fighting that is actually going to ultimately mean our victory. It's the fact of the working class's role in production that means that the working class can take power. What this means is that it's not violence that will determine the success or otherwise of a revolution, but rather these social factors. So working class revolutions are actually much less violent than those that brought to power the minority capitalist classes in, for example, the English and French revolutions. Now, as I've said, the ruling class is a tiny minority. Therefore, they need to recruit from the working class those people who they rely on to keep their power. As we've seen so clearly from the US military today, the military is overwhelmingly recruited from the working class, particularly those poorer sections of the working class, for whom the economic conscription of the military is the only hope of living a life out of poverty. So what happens when the ruling class calls on these people to shoot at other working class people, on their fathers, their sisters, their friends, or just other working class people in a similar situation to them? Even today, the increasing difficulty in keeping military discipline is becoming more and more apparent. With the ever-increasing number of desertions from the American army in the Middle East. Joshua Keyes, who is an Iraq Veterans Against, who's a member of the Iraq Veterans Against the War, which is an organisation which is actually organising people, soldiers who have fought in Iraq and Afghanistan, organising them against the wars there, said of his desertion from the army, "I owe one apology only. That's to the people of Iraq. I apologise for doing the things I did, completely. But as far as being to the US government, no. No, because they lied, they falsified, and they're the ones that put us all there. No, I apologise, and I apologise to one, and that's the Iraqi people." Now, this breakdown in army discipline is heightened in the highly polarised atmosphere of a workers' revolution. It only takes a small amount of encouragement to get sections of the military to decide not to shoot on revolutionaries, and just a little bit more to get them to join the side of the protesters. I think the case of the Tiananmen Square protests in China in 1989 is quite an interesting example of this. In these protests, more than 1 million workers and students protested for democracy and of the system. This is how Time magazine, hardly a revolutionary publication, described the protests. They said, "For 7 weeks in the late spring of 1989, the modern year of revolutions, the Chinese people took back Tiananmen Square. First a few workers and students and teachers and soldiers, then more and more, until more than 1 million had assembled there. They set up in the heart of the ancient nation, their own world within a world, complete with a daily newspaper, a broadcasting tent, even a 30-foot plaster-covered statue they called the Goddess of Democracy. Their spokesmen were 3,000 hunger strikers who spilled all over the central monument to the people's heroes." Now, when the crackdown against the protests occurred, the Chinese government had to bring in troops from far off outside provinces, outside of Beijing, where the mass dissent had not yet reached. They had to do this because the local army units were considered to be too sympathetic to the protest and the people of the city to be effective. The locally stationed 38th Army was reportedly sympathetic to the uprising. They were supplied no ammunition by the government and were said to be torching their own vehicles as they abandoned them to join the protests. So even in the modern, highly disciplined army of a dictatorship like China, dissent in the ranks can mean that the military can come over to our side. And during the most successful workers' revolution, that of Russia, the Russian Revolution of 1917, the working class were even more successful in winning the army over to our side. The Russian socialists, the Bolsheviks, argued stridently for the demands of soldiers in World War I, for peace, for land for the peasantry, and for bread and better conditions in the cities, and were able to convince soldiers politically to stand against the old order. So for workers, political clarity and organisation are just as important weapons in the class struggle as the willingness to defend the revolution. And so revolutions themselves are nowhere near as violent as their reputation suggests. Furthermore, the creation of workers' power in Russia finally brought an end to Russia's participation in the gruesome slaughter of the First World War, which claimed 55 million lives in the name of imperialism, far more than have been lost in any revolution. So despite the fact that it's always attributed to bloodthirsty workers, the violence associated with revolutions is overwhelmingly the violence of the old rulers mobilising their military machines to crush revolution and restore their power and authority. Many more lives were lost after the Russian Revolution as workers defended the revolution against counter-revolutionaries and the 14 invading imperial armies than in the revolution itself. And similarly, it was the defeat of the Chilean Revolution which resulted in the murder of 30,000 of the most militant members of the working class by Pinochet, not the short period of mass upheaval. This large-scale violence of the ruling class is used for a political purpose. It helps to erase the legacy of an inspiring revolutionary struggle through murdering leading workers, as well as intimidating workers in the future from ever attempting such a thing again. Now, while this is tragic, it's not cause to abandon the commitment to revolution, but to make sure it's successful next time by learning from past struggles. Knowing how brutal and murderous the old ruling class is willing to be to maintain its rule and how lethal disorganisation can be puts workers in a better position to win next time, which actually reduces the likelihood of violence. Inevitably, a revolution will involve violence for the same reason not capitulating to the wishes of the US government ends up involving violence, because the people who run society have the means at their disposal to inflict horrendous destruction and will do so when their power is under threat. That's why a world without violence will only be possible when ordinary people take over the running of society from violent warmongers who delight in the prospect of wars lasting for generations. A world without war and violence, one that's based on satisfying human need, is possible because massive wealth is created in the world system by the labour of hundreds of millions of workers who are deprived by this wealth by a tiny minority of capitalists. And much of workers' productive capacity is currently wasted on ways of destroying human life rather than on enhancing it. So it's the social power of workers, united in struggle around the world, which has the potential to not just stop the production of the war machine, but also to bring the system down. Then the creative and productive capacities of workers could be used to build a society in which production is for human need, and war would be remembered with horror as the epitome of the barbarism of capitalism. If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favour freedom yet depreciate agitation are those who want crops without ploughing up the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters.